Wisdom of the day, what have you learnt in the last 24 hours? Michaela says, I've learnt exactly where my Wham cassettes have been for the last 30 years. Only trouble is I now have no cassette player to play them on. Mike Rutherford, do you have a store of cassettes?
I've got a store somewhere. Of old cassettes of bits.
Boxes,
which I'll never go through. Actually, they're just too many. You know, it says bit one, bit two, song one, song two.
And are they full of your songs? Or are they full of other people's songs?
No, my original sort of compositional ideas, you know, bits.
Do you have a cassette player left?
I actually have got one for that reason, but I'd never play it.
Your voice sounds terrific, by the way.
It is actually laryngitis. It's not my lifestyle.
It's nicely timed, though, to promote your
Absolutely.
Your memoir. Actually, do I remember right from the book? Because The Living Years is Mike's memoir. Don't you say that it's Phil Collins who's the cassette man? That he was the guy who collected the cassettes. He had the whole store of everything.
He used to love recording when we were writing sessions. He'd sit there, you know, dying to make a list of bit one, bit two, keeper of the bits. Yeah,
that was his.
He's very organised. Things are all neat and tidy with him. Yeah,
he had other jobs.
He did. Yeah.
So he was the neat and tidy one, as opposed to you.
Yeah.
And Tony.
No, I'm a scruffy one. Tony's the sort of the thinker.
Okay. They're the roles. Here's an email from Judith Warren. And this kind of thing happens, obviously, whenever you put your head above the... head above the pulpit. But anyway. So I used to know Mike when we were young. This is always a scary start. He used to visit his grandma in Farnham. He should remember the Christmas parties at Morris Lodge and the great time we had roaming the grounds. I followed his career with great interest and would just like to be remembered to him. That's Judith Warren. Do you remember?
Well,
do you remember?
I remember Morris Lodge, yeah.
Yeah, and the Christmas parties?
I do.
What went on there?
Not what you're thinking.
Okay. All right, I was just checking. The Living Years by Mike Rutherford, the first Genesis memoir. And it's a fascinating read, Mike. And there's lots of Genesis stuff, lots of family stuff as well. It's not a kind of a debauched rock and roll memoir, which it may be that no one is expecting, it has to be said. But what was it that made you think, okay, now's the right time to sit down and write this?
Well, really, I found my father's old trunks in the attic, and I opened them up and I found my grandfather's two published books about army doctoring, well received. My father's manuscript, unpublished, about his life in the Royal Navy. And I'm seeing these three books in front of me. I think I must address his legacy. And on top of which, I think that generational change in the 60s was a big moment in time. You know, prior to the 60s, young men aspired to be their fathers. In the 60s, anything but. And that big left turn, I think, was really what the book's about, you know, that my father's time to my time.
But you write very warmly about your father. But so how would you describe your relationship there? Because you make it very clear that you didn't want to be him. And there were the obvious battles which you would have as a kid growing up in the 60s, particularly with a naval captain as a father. But how would you describe your relationship then?
Well, it's kind of hard because in my era, people my age, there wasn't much communication. I mean, they came out of two world wars. You know, my parents' generation, they were in shock, really. You know, they were stunned. And I think they just couldn't really communicate. And so we appeared with long hair and guitars and rock, pop music. They couldn't understand it. They didn't so much dislike it as they really could understand what it's all about. So foreign to them.
Yes. You say you make it quite clear in your book, though, so it's a lot about your father and your father's memoir. But you do say... I took after my mother.
Absolutely. She was the sort of dotty, arty one.
Well, I was going to ask, because you call her a wonderful dotty woman. Let's explain a little bit about what that was like. And so you have the naval captain father and the slightly dotty mother. That makes for an interesting household, I think, Mike.
It does, in a sense. You know, I mean, I think also my father, the naval life is always very structured and organised. And she was always disorganised, rushing around, you know, arty, encouraging me to play guitar, playing loud at night. She loved it, you know.
But your father thought what?
He didn't understand it. I mean, the first amplifier, he walked around the house tapping it in case he was going to, you know, shake the foundations out. Because, you know, electric guitar was so foreign in those days.
So what would be the music? Would they have had music in the house?
They didn't. I mean, their friends, they never did nothing at all. No, so the first music was my sister's gramophone player and then my little Selma Goliath amplifier, which scared everyone.
So you were discovering music. That was a school-based activity.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time that you picked something up or sang or something? You thought, well,
yeah, I sang Michael Rowe the Boat Ashore when I was about 11 at prep school.
And what did you think?
It wasn't great, I have to be honest, but I loved the moment, yeah.
But was that the last time you were a lead vocalist?
Just about. I should have learned.
And there's some splendid nostalgic references to Pick of the Pops. and Radio Luxembourg, which people of a certain generation will just love going through. But they were important shows, and many people listening now, as I did, would have fallen asleep listening to Radio Luxembourg.
Yeah, I mean, all the time. Life. I mean, I tell my kids that they're grown up now that, you know, imagine you heard pop music once a week on Sunday afternoon. You know, now every radio station, every bookstore, airport, restaurant is blaring out. It was such a foreign thing then.
The most foreign thing, which trumps that, is dial-a-disc. When you explain to your children that you could phone a number and hear one pop song a day played down the phone, the same one, and it would cost money.
Times have changed, haven't
they? Absolutely. But, and here's the... So, give yourself 20 seconds. So, here's the question. Who was your first hero? Just give everyone a chance to think of the answer. Mike Rutherford's first music hero. We're talking rock and roll. We're talking about the era of pop. Makes it very clear in his book, The Living Years. We're going to play that in just a moment. Who would you think Mike Rutherford's first ever hero? Okay, time is up. Give us the answer.
Cliff. He was so cool. Cliff in the Shadows. That song, Move It. I mean, it was a great rock and roll sound. I mean, over the years, his career's changed. But I mean, then he was it.
What do you remember of seeing Cliff in the Shads? Was it the Apollo in Manchester?
Yeah, they all wore sort of black and white suits, different. One had a black jacket, you know, hair greased back, you know, and the sound, I mean, the sound was so raw to my ears.
And did you watch that and think, it matters what you wear? It matters what the sound is, but it actually matters what you wear or not?
Well, I forgot that now until, because in fact, for the next 10 years, I wore T-shirts, or 20 years, you know what I mean?
Although the black and white suits actually do...
Okay, it came back eventually on the back cover, yeah.
Yeah, do make an appearance. So the song The Living Years is obviously is where the title of the memoir, a perfect name for a memoir. And this is really the first sort of chapter of the book, isn't it? Your father's passing it starts.
It was a strange time, you know. It was sort of, I was in this rock and roll bubble, you know. It was going fantastically. I was touring the world in the 80s and had this huge year tour, The Invisible Touch, and then The Mechanics were doing well, and he passed away in the middle of a tour. And so really the next stage was to, I had to fly back in the funeral and finish the show that night in LA, you know, which led on really to going back to another album with and I wrote with Bea Robertson, my co-writer in The Living Years, and it's his lyric, I should mention that too. And we both lost fathers at the same time, had new babies, and suddenly the song, which could have been a crash, had not worked, you know, and then Paul Carrack sang it, and his father died when he was young.
What a great vocal.
So, yeah, I mean, his father would die when he was a young boy, so actually the whole thing sort of came together.
Did you know when it was being created and composed and recorded that it would touch so many people?
I didn't, but Chris Neil, the producer, said to me at the end, shook my hand, said to me, Mike, that's one of my most special moments ever recording, and I kind of passed me by, you know.
Mike Rutherford, The Living Years. We'll play the song and talk more with Mike in a moment. 6:23, Mike Rutherford is here. The Living Years is his memoir. And for someone who, as you say in the book, you know, you say what you did get from your dad is that, you know, you don't talk about emotions very much, or you never have done in the past. Was it difficult, just the process of writing the book, when we are expecting a degree of that?
I think so, but if you're going to embark on a book, that's the whole point of it, really, to express your feelings. You never really expressed when he was alive.
Did you find it difficult to put it down on paper? Or was it easier to put it down on paper than to actually have the conversation?
Yes and no. I mean, my wife, Angie, helped me a lot because she was there all the time. We'd been married for 37 years, so she knew my voice and bits I forgot she remembered. But she knew that my emotions too. She's a more emotional person, so she drags it out of me, which helped quite a lot.
David in Bucks on this text, please could you thank Mike for The Living Years? It prompted me to write to my father telling him how much I loved him, and he died not long after that. I imagine with such an enormous song, as that was a US number one, number one all over the world, you'll be familiar with
it. I do. I know that both Bea and I get this all the time, which is wonderful. You know, a song to change someone's life. I mean, how incredible is that?
It was the power of having a song which was everywhere and was such a huge hit and about such a difficult subject, and that doesn't really happen very much.
No, I know. And it worked. It's everything. It's luck and skill and timing too.
Luck, skill and timing.
And a bit more luck. It is. You know it works.
And a bit of skill in there. Howard on this, Mike, thank you very much for Six of the Best. Got me into Genesis and playing on your birthday. I played truant. This is Jerry and Ashby de la Zouche. I played truant from boarding school about 1970 to go to a Ralph McTell gig in Canterbury. The support band were Genesis.
There you go. I actually remember that one, funny enough.
Do you?
I remember the early shows.
I imagine they're all a blur.
No, the early shows stick out more because they're more special. Once you get into sort of arenas in America and stadiums, they all blur. They're the same. It's brick and concrete. But the early ones stick out more.
How would you describe going to a Genesis gig around about 1969, 1970? What would we have seen and what would we have heard?
Probably quite a lack of people for a start. Definitely. A hardcore following, mainly male at the front, you know, in overcoats. But a sort of the start of, you know, like the intensity was there even then, I think.
Well, the intensity from the followers?
And the band, I think, yeah.
And did they know all the words?
They did, yeah.
And did they follow you around?
Yes. Aylesbury was our hardcore centre for, you know, that kind of got us going.
Did you recognise them?
Oh, yeah.
Day after. Were they Genesis groupies?
Not for a bit, no, because we were just the sort of, you know, five long-haired kids trying to prove their point.
Is one of the reasons why you're all, and I'm using this as a compliment, normal guys, is that the success came to you over quite a period of time. You know, if you'd had a huge number one in 1968, followed by a number one album, and so, I mean, you had songs in 1968, but if you'd been absolutely huge, do you think...
No, it does help. First of all, we're mates from way back, you know, in school, so you can't get a big ego, but it does help because you've grown slowly. That apprenticeship, which you don't get anymore, you know, since MTV and everything and the television, you could just learn your craft slowly over two or three albums and get a feel for it. It's a very good grounding, yeah.
Art Garfunkel says he never had a more exciting experience than hearing Sounds of Silence on the radio for the first time, their first hit. In the book you talk about here, it was Silent Sun, wasn't
it? Silent Sun, yeah.
In 1968, and Kenny Everett playing it. Do you remember hearing your stuff on the radio for the first time?
I do. I know where I was hearing that song. I was in Aunt Phillips's kitchen in Ripley in Surrey, and I remember the moment, you know, very exciting. I thought I'd made it. I thought I was there. All done, you know.
Did it sound different?
It sounded very exciting. First time round, yeah. I really thought this is it. We thought we bought our outfits, Top of the Pops, and here we come.
Meantime, though, your father presumably thought you should be carrying on with your education. Was it Edinburgh University? Because you've been kicked out of Charterhouse.
Yeah. I did A-levels at Farnborough Tech, so I did my bit there, which is fair enough, and then got into Edinburgh University to read English, but started the band, and luckily made the right choice, I think.
Yeah. And what did... To the extent that he talked about it, what did your dad? I mean, did your dad sit down and listen to From Genesis to Revelation?
I don't think he couldn't understand our music really. I remember a meeting at his club. It's in the book, you know. His Royal Naval Club in St James's, his three piece suit, and I've got long hair to meet him, an Afghan coat, flared velvet trousers, and the doorman kind of eyes me up like, you know, what's this? In his club, discussing my future, you know, and I'm sure he thought, please, a couple of years, he'll grow out of it, but. See your kids obsessed, you can't, and working hard, you can't say no to them.
And he was smart enough to realise?
Or maybe wise enough, you know what I mean? I think the naval guys are quite wise. He's been around the world, been in 1.5 world wars, you know, it's a different time for them.
Yeah. Neil Pearson on this email from Thornaby in Cleveland is looking forward to getting your book at the weekend. And he said, as I imagine everyone else is, could you ask Mike what he thinks about Phil Collins' comments before Christmas that he was thinking of getting back into making music again?
Well, actually, that's great, because I know Phil kind of sort of semi-retired a few years ago, and I think he got a bit down. It's a hard... His work regime was so serious for years, like all of us. When you suddenly stop, you can't just stop. And I think... I saw him a few times over the last couple of years, and I think he's such a musical person. I think he missed it. So whatever he does, I feel he's back in to do something again, which is good. Who knows? Who knows?
Never say never.
Yeah.
Meantime, Mike and the Mechanics, they're off on tour. So Real Pavilion, February the 12th. Do you still have the appetite, after all these years, Mike, you still have the appetite for Home Firth Picture Drome, Buxton Opera House, Norwich Theatre Royal, this is a relentless pace, Kingsley and Corn Exchange, all the way through to March the 16th at the old Hammersmith Apollo. You still want to do
again,
that?
Well, occasionally, I must admit, the Mechanics 3 years ago, I thought, I was in Brighton Dome, and I thought, hang on, I was here 43 years ago, and I'm still here. I thought, is this all right? You know what I mean? Am I okay doing this? But the band is such fun. I mean, the song's great fun to play on stage. And Roachford and Tim and everything, they're great, exciting stage people.
You should get Ralph McTell to support you just to swap that round from 1970. Good, yeah. Mike Rutherford, a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Mike's book is The Living Years.